more, and you can always give to this radio station at any time by going to give to WBAI.org online. Now stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The new school will be 100 years old on October 6th, and it has commissioned one of its distinguished faculty members, novelist, playwright, essayist, and poet John Reed, to write a history. The result, A Drama in Time, The New School's Century, which is published by Profile Books, brings John Reed to our show now. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks so much for having me on.
Although you've been published extensively, have you written much history?
Well, I have a few history projects and a few history. My first novel was a historical novel, and I've been working on another for about a decade. And the arts, the 20th century and the arts is something I've written about extensively.
Because you've written for some art magazines, haven't you?
Yes, I spent quite a while writing for Art Forum, doing the kind of beat, as well as Art in America.
But if people look you up, they'll find out that you didn't write 10 Days That Shook the World.
No, I didn't write
Has that been difficult, to keep bearing that name, John Reed?
Well, sometimes I lie about it, so...
Yeah, the result is a rather unorthodox book, a non-linear collection of stories. It's a huge coffee table size book that's filled with lots of illustrations, over 400 images from the school's archives. Was that your idea from the start?
Well, so it came to me as a kind of a problem. And maybe a year ago, it was really much too late to be thinking about a book of this scope, a project of this scope. And the idea was that there would be some kind of narrative history of this school. To me, a gigantic book of text seemed, you know, really boring. We did have this marvelous archive, and that seemed like something we could draw on. On the other hand, the individual stories seemed almost more important to me than the epic narrative.
So each story contains a title, body copy, photos with captions, pull-out quotes from recognizable members of our community, historical and modern courses and related events and happenings and publications that cross time periods and schools, giving us a sense of how the new school is as opposed to other schools.
Yeah, that was the idea, that it would be a character portrait, so that we would make the internal story more important than the historical narrative, and draw out the characteristics of the school in a kind of a hero's journey that was more about the development of the character of the school.
To be honest, I was surprised to learn that the school was founded in 1919, because the only history I'd heard was that emigre university professors were invited to teach there after the rise of Mussolini and Hitler.
It's common that people mark the beginning of the school in the 30s with the beginning of the graduate faculty. That was a really heroic moment of the school, but it was also the beginning of the essential conflict of the identity of the new school.
But doesn't the story really begin at Columbia University over
issues of
politics, academic freedom, and educational philosophy?
I might even put it a little farther back than that. I might put the beginning of the school back to the settlement house movement, the kind of idea of education that was changing at the end of the 19th century. But then at Columbia, there were a number of professors who objected to the draft. They weren't necessarily pacifists, but they didn't want people to have to be drafted.
Columbia's president, Nicholas Murray Butler, demanded during World War I that members of the faculty sign a loyalty oath. That was before Eugene McCarthy.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe McCarthy. Forgive me, Eugene. Before Joe McCarthy.
Well, Columbia had a number of really quite idealistic professors. The administration at Columbia, which is my alma mater, is not particularly idealistic. So there was that difficulty with the faculty, and there were some very difficult faculty members. That came to a crisis, which caused several of the faculty members to leave and sort of start this new school.
And they, some of them were a little radical, one of them wrote, He has stifled all principles of fair and objective education. Manly independence and individuality, wherever it was, it has exhibited itself at college. All noble idealism and all the graces of poetry and art have been shriveled by his brutal and triumphant power. Wow.
Yes, it's very bombastic kind of period sentiment from the Alumni Association, which was angered that he had taken the step to dismiss faculty without any consultation.
So a number of the Columbia University professors were fired. And then a very well-known historian, Charles A. Beard, resigned. And this was what got the ball rolling?
Yeah, and there was also quite a bit of interest in what was new and what was progressive. There was a trend of the new history, the new republic. In fact, quite a bit of the new school may have been formed out of the back offices of the new republic. One of the major financiers of the school, Dorothy Whitney Strait, was married to one of the New Republic editors, and she was a co-founder of the New Republic. It seemed Alvin Johnson, who would later be the president of the New School, was one of the editors. It seems like the New Republic also played a major role.
So that's why where the word new comes from here? Because and many people have wondered why it was called the New School rather than the New University. Wasn't the goal to create some kind of alternative university?
Yes, it was very much an idea that the school would represent a new education that didn't really need degrees, and that as we came to the end of class society, we wouldn't require those kind of vestments in terms of education, that we could just go in and learn whatever we wanted. I should also say that one of the things that we uncovered during the course of this book is a book by Evelyn Dewey. So often the new school is talked about with John Dewey as a founder. He wasn't quite a founder, but he was involved early on. And his daughter published, I believe in 1918, a book called The New School. She was a co-writer with him. She was investigating much more kind of activist engagements with education.
Charles Beard wrote a book in 1913 called An Economic Interpretation of the United States, which got a bad review in the New York Times because it was so radical. He wrote that he sought to show that the founders of this republic and the authors of the Constitution were a ring of land speculators and who bestowed upon the country a body of organic law drawn up chiefly in the interest of their own pockets. Now, this is at the time right before the Soviet Revolution.
Yeah, he didn't actually stay in academia. He moved out just to be a radical and to write books. Although his economic critique of the U.S. at this time doesn't look particularly radical.
Among the founding premises of the school was that there would be no need for an academic degree when class society came to an end.
Yes, and that's the one area I think that the school has really changed on, which brings us back to the university in exile. The very radical notion of the new school as a lifelong learning institution came into conflict with the graduate faculty. So these German professors, for the most part, there were quite a few Italians, quite a few Europeans, who were really the best of what Europe had to offer. Very, very famous. And it was an opportunity. The new school has always been opportunistic. And it brought 180-plus scholars over from Europe who were fleeing fascist Europe. They came through the school, and many stayed in permanent faculty positions. These were people very often who had an influence on the initial idea of what the new school would be, although the new school was more radical than anything they had envisioned in Europe. When they came here, they instituted a much more conservative kind of education model, which required graduate degrees, which was very formal in its ways. And that's really at the heart of the new school's conflict to this day. Is it this more academic model that it's very much out of the tradition of Europe, or is it this wild progressive American thing?
With a strong emphasis on the word secular over in the early writings, Now, why was it called the New School of Social Research from the start?
That's a little unclear to me. It seems like it was, but it's also quite often just referred to as the New School.
And at one point, it was called the New School University from 1997 to 2005.
Yeah, it was the New School University for a while, and it's still the university part seems to have stuck to some degree.
Does it qualify as a university in the sense of Yale, Harvard, Columbia, or CUNY for that matter?
Well, it's smaller. It's a little smaller, but I think it has pretty much all the trappings.
Because it has a whole bunch of different schools that focus on a wide range of things?
I think it has 134 degrees or 134 degrees in programs. I'm not quite sure. But it's a big institution with quite a few offerings.
And now it's five schools plus a European, a French school as well, right?
It has a campus in Paris. Actually always had campuses abroad. It was very involved in, after the war, in sort of maintaining and resurrecting French institutions of higher learning. The French necessarily would take them back and destroy them in a typical French fashion.
Didn't de Gaulle encourage the New School to open a school?
We had what was the Ecole Libre, which was the only free French university during the war. And we also had Atelier 17 was involved in the New School. We had Parsons had a very early academic campus in Paris, which then was chased out and returned. We had campuses in London and Italy. Those things are hard to maintain.
And then it's also launched or housed the World Policy Institute, the Philip Glass Institute, the Vera List Center for Art and Politics, the India-China Institute, the Observatory on Latin America, and the Center for New York City Affairs.
Yes, indeed. And we're looking at further campus expansions.
Now, in looking over the names of the people who were involved in creating it, how many women were involved?
Well, the early history of the New School, it's very difficult to put an exact mark on who the founders were. But the list that I refer to has 10 women and 9 men on it. They were all quite influential women. I think that the initial advertising of the school, which claimed that there were 30% men, was marketing to women who were interested in meeting men, but also it was trying to distinguish itself from the suffragette movement, which was really, really instrumental in forming the school. The first sponsor of the school, Dorothy Whitney Strait, was the president of the Junior League at the time and was trying to set it up so that the New School would be the Junior League sort of offshoot for higher education. Education for women at the time was not presumed to have a degree track. She was enormously disappointed when Barnard ended up taking on the role. The New School was considered too radical. She continued to support the school, but I think that the school tried to distance itself from its suffragette beginnings at a certain point.
Well, too radical. It definitely does sound like something that was a reflection of the most radical ideas of the times. One of the people who played a role in it who wound up not staying was James Cattell. He published a book in 1913 called University Control, and he proposed, he called for higher education that eliminated administration and trustees and granted full power to faculty.
They tried it. They tried it for about 7 semesters, and at that point, they had to bring in an administration. It wasn't working out. I don't know the exact details of it. It just seems like nobody was doing the paperwork. And, Alvin Johnson at that point was appointed the president of the school and came in and really tried to turn it into an organization that could last.
And he was one of the founders. He was an economist and literary scholar, Alvin Johnson. There was also, Charles Beard, who later quit. Some of the very famous economists, Thorsten Veblen, James Harvey Robinson, philosophers Horace and Callan, and John Dewey was there as well, no?
Dewey was in China, but He was here for the first semester, and then he went to China. He did have a deep influence on the school, I think. In retrospect, he would do these tours with his daughters and his, I think starting in his 70s, birthday parties where they took probably more credit than they should have. But I would put the real founders as Alvin Johnson, or rather the builders, co-builder, as Johnson and Clara Mayer, who was a student of Robinson's, who left Columbia when he left Columbia. And she was really Johnson's right-hand player throughout the history of the school, enormously influential to the school.
John Reed's book is A Drama in Time, The New School Century, published by Profile Books. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. The first course catalog began. The New School for Social Research is organized to meet the needs of intelligent men and women interested in the grave social, political, economic, and educational problems of the day. So did that attract a lot of students?
It did. It was fairly successful in its first semesters. They had to move from the London Terrace building down to the 66 West Paul Street.
So they were in
building.
Chelsea originally.
They were originally in Chelsea and quickly outgrew it. They also wanted to add a new kind of course, which would be workshop courses. In the first semesters downtown, they added puppeteer courses, what would be the first writing workshops for credit, or for rather in an academic institution. This workshop model wasn't original to the founding of the school, but quickly became important to it.
Was the desire to blur distinctions between departments something that was there from the start?
It was there from the start, and it's always been a difficult thing to keep up.
I'll bet, because people want to protect their own turf. But that's been one of the things that has distinguished the new school and attracted people to it, that you're not just stuck in one school and you can't really pay much attention to the others.
The protean nature of the school is an ongoing struggle, but one of its great advantages. To this day, you have different departments trying to work together and failing and sometimes succeeding. But, you know, it's the only place I've taught in New York City where you can propose a bonkers course and they just let you do it. And it's okay. It's okay sometimes to fail in a course. You know, people try to do it and it doesn't work, and that's really part of the culture of the school.
Have you proposed any bonkers courses?
Oh, I have had some bonkers courses, and we've had...
Have you regretted them, or have they turned out to be exciting?
I always had a good time. We had a course where we were supposed to cooperate with a media course, where we were...
Cooperate with the media? Trump would not take that course.
No, he would not have been in there, but... It was two courses, so it was two separate classes that were supposed to be integrated. My class would write, the media people would direct and produce. But of course, the writers thought that they could direct and produce, and their producers thought that they could write. And we ended up in a rancorous division. And both of us did okay, but would have done much better with each other. It was a marvelous lesson.
But these things... could work out. What do you think? Is it just personalities that prevent some of these things from working out? Because the idea seems good to me.
I think that the real lesson is the challenge of participating in culture. You know, you have different market values, different categories. You know, you're up against real economic incentives to stay separate.
So they moved from Chelsea to the northern Greenwich Village. And now there are buildings all over. But haven't several of the university buildings been certified by New York City as historical landmarks?
The building, the 66 West 12th Street building, is a landmark. I think maybe only the auditorium is a landmark, but I believe the facade is a landmark as well.
Tishman Auditorium is considered by many to be the first building to employ modern architecture.
It's an extraordinary building, and they fully renovated that area in the building in 1992. So you can really get a sense of that building in there. It was the building is actually designed like a stage set, so the front is only a facade. It's not connected to the rest of the building. I do have a fantasy that one day they'll just restore the whole thing. It would be absolutely amazing.
What's performed there now?
there are constant events there. I mean, in terms of the writing program, we have several awards, the National Book Critics Circle Awards, the Triangle Awards. It's in constant use.
In the first semester, 100 courses, mostly in economics and politics, were offered by the faculty, some pretty famous people in that faculty, including, we mentioned Beard, but also Thomas Sewell Adams, Harold Lasky, Thorsten Veblen, James Harvey Robinson, Charles B. Davenport, Elsie Clues Parsons. But they were just lecture classes?
In the beginning, they were just lecture classes. The first 10 years were just lecture classes.
Students hate lecture classes.
Well, it was different, I think. There was no social media. People went out to meet each other. It was very much part of the sort of ethos of New York City that you would go out and learn something and have dinner and be civilized.
So what happened? When did it become more like other schools?
Well, I think it happened.
Because the early approach was untenable? I mean, every university still has lecture classes.
I think it was two things. One was the influence of these workshop-style courses, which mm-hmm. were meant to be very hands-on. People would go in and learn by doing. And that was the new idea. And once that was put into practice, it fit in so well with the idea of what the school was that it quickly became integrated. The other thing was the graduate faculty. So the school started with graduate degrees. The first degrees offered by the school were PhDs. And that's a very conservative system.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have a real undergraduate system?
Not really until post-World War II, when there was an idea mounted that the returning soldiers would be more progressive and more global and needed education. It was a little mercenary to take advantage of some of the money offered by the government, but also a good idea.
Well, the government was paying for the educations of people who, soldiers who came back.
We're coming right back to Greenwich Village, of course.
Now, the school has attracted some pretty famous teachers and students over the years. Karen Horney, Norman Mailer, Lee Strasberg, all for different departments and at different times. But should we be surprised? Did they see this as an opportunity to do things they couldn't do elsewhere?
Well, I think that's very much what the school was. People came in with schemes, and very often the administration would say yes. There's still somewhat of that culture now, this model of experimentation in the academic environment is something I really haven't seen, having taught at Columbia and NYU and Fordham. And those are schools I like teaching at. The sort of mentality of just let's see what happens is something I think I would ascribe that. Well, that's really part of what the new school is.
So let's see what happens. And if it succeeds, then you continue with it. And if it doesn't, oh, well, you shrug and say, let's find something else.
There were some not so great ideas, like there was an experimental television division, which didn't work out. But, I can see being seduced by that notion.
Mm-hmm. And why didn't it work out?
Because it folded into, very often what happens is these and this is one thing that I learned over the course of looking at the history for 100 years, is these radical sort of offshoots that look like they're going to be new fields fold into other fields. So that the experimental television, which didn't look like it was part of media, eventually became part of media, and media is really part of film. And so these things tend to kind of crunch together as time passes.
You mentioned earlier the new school's establishment of the University of Exile and the École Libre des Hautes Études fairly early, 1933?
Yes, it was very early that the new school was involved in or really foresaw what would happen in Europe. They were involved from the early 30s forward. I might even say a couple of years before that.
Well, 33 is I guess, the official right. year, but that's when Hitler rises to power.
Right, but Johnson was also working on an encyclopedia of intellectuals for years before that. So he'd already had an opportunity to develop connections, and he seemed quite aware of the temperature in Europe.
And some of the notable scholars who were associated with it were Eric Fromm, Hannah Arendt, Leo Strauss. You would have thought that other more powerful universities would have tried to have attracted them.
Well, Hannah Arendt came a little later. She started at the school, I believe, in 1965, although sometimes people dated it 67. I came up with 65. She had been at the school earlier, giving large-scale lecture courses in the early 50s. But she was radical. She was a radical figure. She was still publishing her Eichmann essays at the end of that time. She had some very unpopular positions. In terms of not only in terms of Israel, but in terms of busing, and she was an iconoclast and really did her own thing.
And didn't Leo Strauss become an influence on conservative thinking in America?
Well, that was an interesting progression.
So he was the University of Chicago after, wasn't he? Well, maybe I'm confusing him with somebody else.
That may be right. I don't know. The arc of the graduate faculty was one of, radical progressives to people who really resisted the 60s and didn't understand what was going on with this generation. When the SDS was involved at Columbia and the New School, so the Students for Democratic Society was really only involved in New York City at the New School and Columbia. It wasn't
No. The city's colleges had...
Oh, the city... You might be right about
Brooklyn
that.
Brooklyn College, they took over the administrative buildings. I think probably City College as well.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. NYU was not an active campus. But those were NYU, or rather the New School, had a real problem with the graduate faculty who were in direct conflict with the students at that moment. And that was really a defining point of the school where the graduate faculty had to step back. And the other part of the school, the more radical part of the school, had to assert itself with undergraduate degrees and a sort of broadening of the educational system.
We mentioned the École Libre des Études, which began when the Nazis invaded France, and was given a charter by the French government in exile. It attracted Jacques Maritain, Claude Lévi-Strauss, Roman Jakobson. Amazing that these people all taught at the New School.
The list of faculty at the New School over the 100 years is really unbelievable. What I came across is only a portion, because in the higher levels of the school, when you're looking at PhD programs or MFA programs, you don't have as good a record. So as amazing as this list of faculty is, it's very, very partial.
And who are some of the others that I'm missing?
I could turn to the book, but just thinking about the ones you were talking about, Maritain brought in Mailer, of course, mm-hmm. who was here for a bit. And we had, shall I be looking at the book here? Why don't I just stay with the writing
department?
Okay,
it's okay. Yeah.
We had Amiri Baraka.
Amiri Baraka, what? Yeah.
Sure.
James Baldwin was a student.
Baldwin was a student here at the dramatic workshop. Along with Marlon Brando and Sidney Poitier and that whole cast of characters.
Okay, you also had Beatrice Arthur, Harry Belafonte, Tony Curtis, Ben Gazzara, Rod Steiger, Elaine Stritch, Shelley Winters, and Tennessee Williams. Wow, I didn't realize Tennessee Williams went to the New School. It ended in 1948.
Well, the dramatic workshop ended partly because of the good affiliations that we had established with the CIA while bringing over the refugee scholars. We had a bit of a McCarthyism problem, a Red Scare problem, and the dramatic workshop was a little too red.
Some of the teachers there included Stella Adler and Ilya Kazan.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been a great time.
Maria Le Piscator, who was involved in it, kept coming back, I think, through the 80s and 90s.
He was the great German theater director.
Yes. I was speaking about Maria, who was his wife, but she was also quite influential in the school, and it seems that she really ran the school as he was increasingly not well.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Everybody needs an education. Everybody needs an education. Black skin, red skin, yellow or white. Everybody needs to read and write. Everybody needs an education.
We're back with John Reed, who has published, among other things, four novels?
Yes, depending on how you count them.
Because one of them is called All the World's a Grave, a new play by William Shakespeare. And that's not a play. You have written
it
a
play.
It is a play.
So what I did in that project was I took apart the known works of Shakespeare and fitted them back together as a new play.
Mm-hmm.
So Romeo goes to war for Juliet, a kind of bloody, unnecessary war, captures her from her father Lear, brings her back. The Iago sees his opportunity, and everything unravels from there.
And then a volume of poetry and other plays and a lot of essays. So you've been all over the place just having fun as a writer?
I have been. I've been trying to just do what I feel like doing. When I picked up my MFA, there was a sense you really couldn't do that. You had to do just one thing. But now there's really not that feeling. So I'm enjoying indulging myself.
And the latest, what we've been discussing, is a history of the New School called A Drama in Time, the New School Century. It's published by Profile Books. And it's filled with illustrations, photographs, and artwork. You must have had help.
Oh yeah, I had there were a huge number of people working on this book and helping to get it to happen. I had researchers, and there were specific dedicated photo researchers. Catherine Thomas was quite amazing. Samantha Kirby, who helped me, Ashley Bruni, who was working at the school. There were so many people who contributed to this book. The designer Justine Branwart, they're just amazing people.
So let's go back. The school is created in 1919. It kind of figures out how it wants to function. And then the next thing we were talking about is 1933. What happened in between? Was it building? Was it a success? Were people drawn to New York to go there as opposed to going to NYU or to Columbia, Barnard, or some of the other, Fordham, some of the other major schools here?
It had a very different function at that moment. It was an institution where you would go in a non-committed way to a lecture about something that interested you. There weren't media outlets to find out about these things in the way there are today. There wasn't YouTube. There wasn't really, a network of television that you could tune into and learn these things. It was really an of-the-moment way to pick up information. It was also a way to socialize. Very important to the history of the school. People are negative about it now, that it was a dating scene in the 70s, but I feel like, you know, people wanted to go there to date and take a class about, take a class about some exotic artist. It seems like divine.
What about pay? Because we did a show recently on adjuncts, and there were some issues at the New School.
Yeah, the New School is unionized on that side. And I'm full-time faculty now, but I've been on the union side of it. I don't know if the New School is worse than other schools or better than other schools or about the same. It seems to me like a national problem more than just a New School problem. Although the New School people are very vocal, so it may seem like it's more of a problem there.
One-third of the students are international, 112 foreign countries being represented. So obviously people know about it around the world.
I think a big part of that is Parsons, which has an international reputation. And also increasingly, U.S. schools are taking on more foreign students. I think that's very positive. Of course, it's also just part of the economic landscape of the world.
How does it the cost compare to other schools that it is competing with?
I think it's pretty much in line with other private private university colleges. It's not. It's more than a city college for sure. I've taught at FIT. You know, the problem, of course, is that when students pay much less, faculty get paid much less.
Of the entire student population, 63% receive financial aid.
Yeah, so. I think that that's also probably pretty typical of U.S. schools, although the New School does seem to make an effort, from my perspective, to stay loyal to its own people. That does seem like a real part of the sort of community of the school.
I was interested to note that 43% of the students are people of color, and 5% of the American students identify as being of more than one race. So that's probably a higher percentage than most schools.
It may be, although I think the New School could do better. I mean, its history in the 100 years, in its century, are mediocre when it comes to race in the U.S. In 1919, the founding of the school, the year that the school was founded, it was the Red Summer, which was a series of murders of returning African-American World War I veterans that occurred in, I think, 25 U.S. cities. I believe there may be mention of race internationally in the course catalogs of spring and fall 1919, but there's no mention of it in terms of U.S. In terms of U.S. contemporary life. It's been very hit or miss over the course of the century. I think with all of its progressive values, that's the first thing that the school has been willing to set aside. I do think since the 90s, it's really made an effort to address that.
Now, after World War II, we had the McCarthy era, and here we have this school that many people thought of as a rather radical school. Did the government pay attention?
Well, I think that the school, I can't prove it. This is one of the things that I would love other people to pick up. But the school has always been involved with governmental people from the very beginning. It seems to me that it's always had an attachment to a kind of progressive government side. And that turned through the 30s into the post-World War II anti-Russia sentiment, which morphed into the Cold War. We had a number of those people involved in the faculty. It seems very, very clear that the CIA had infiltrated the campus. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, those people, you know, they were all at the New School. They were all in New York City. The curator at the New School, Paul Maschiani, I think that's how his name is said, volunteered to work with the New School, the CIA at one point. He also stole quite a bit of art. It's very, very charming rogue. His letters are hysterical. You can read his letters today and just be laughing. But I think he was indicative of that period.
Now you say he stole art. The New School has art schools, and there was and murals were also painted by Orozco.
Yeah.
So what happened? Has some of the art just disappeared?
Yes, some of the arches disappeared. The Orozco murals are still there and in good shape.
But haven't they been controversial over the years?
They have been. They were covered up almost in their entirety at one point, and then a portion of them, which depicted the Russian Revolution, were covered up for almost 10 years. Eventually, it was that curtain, the yellow curtain, was taken down. The dates on that are a little fuzzy, but we have it pretty much fixed to that, you know, to that period. I think it was a compromise. It was a pretty lame compromise to put a curtain over the murals. But
well, it's better than painting over them
right,
or destroying them.
It's better than destroying them. And I think
after
that's
all, Ruskoe
John...
was a major artist.
Yeah.
So perhaps the feeling was someday we'll be able to show these paintings again.
Yeah, I think that was
the logic. They're works of history, aren't they, rather than works of propaganda?
Yeah. We did move the Thomas Hart Benton out of the school in the 80s. Ostensibly because we needed the money and they needed to be restored, but that was probably due to his unpopular place in culture in the 80s. He had been involved in some conservative Midwestern organizations, and it was just unpalatable.
Although he was Jackson Pollock's teacher.
Pollock was actually in the mural, was in the mural
really?
As a model, yeah.
But that was at the Art Students League, no relation at all with the New School.
Pollock, I think Pollock was did have some affiliation with the New School, at the very least through Atelier 17.
Hmm. Who else because we're talking about the New School being a major center for music, for theater, and for the arts.
Well, Copeland obviously was at the New
Aaron
School.
Aaron Copeland,
and hugely influential to it. Martha Graham, is talked about as someone who was influential to the New School. And sometimes I guess there's a criticism that the New School overstates that. But in fact, the New School was influential to her. She taught at the New School earlier in her teaching life, took on the workshop model, which she then evolved. And she came back at one point when there was talk of bringing in an experimental dance wing of the school. So I don't know if it's overstated or maybe just a little bit of a optimistic read on the history.
A number of schools of music. There's a school of jazz and the Manus School of Music.
So the Manus School came in much later, and the Manus School is also quite conservative in terms of the overall look of the school. But the dance side connects Manus and the New School. That modern dance era, there is quite a bit of overlap. And Charles Seeger taught at both schools.
So what happened? We have Parsons, we have Manus. They're schools, independent schools, and then they become incorporated into the New School?
So that's what happened. The history of Parsons and the New School is much easier to tie together because they had quite a bit in the way of overlapping faculty. A number of professors were members of the American Artist Congress in the 30s, which was hosted by the New School, a radical artist organization. And the original intention of Parsons was to have an egalitarian approach to design and the arts, which is very much in keeping with the New School philosophy.
Unlike most U.S. universities, doesn't the New School have a student-directed curriculum?
I don't know how much that's true. Oh gosh, I'm flummoxed by that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is part of at least the official description. That doesn't mean it happens. I'm getting the feeling that sometimes idealism clashes with reality in a school like the New School, or perhaps any school.
Well, I mean, it certainly seems feasible. Students ask for courses that then appear. Maybe that's a better way to talk about it.
The New School's College of Performing Arts is home to the experimental music venue, The Stone. And they offer lots of concerts each year, 240 concerts.
Well, that's always been part of the history of the school. Leopold Manus, if we're going to include Manus in that long history, of course, gave his free concerts for decades.
So in doing this history, you must have come across all sorts of surprises and a few mysteries that you still haven't been able to answer. Let's talk about the surprises.
Well, I would love it if people would sort out some of the mysteries. Uh-huh. There's always been a debate at the New School about Baldwin's affiliation with the school. It seems that he was clearly involved in the school to some degree. He went to the dramatic workshop, took courses there. If someone were to really dig into his archive, I'm sure that they would find more. But He was roommates with Marlon Brando, and I think that there's quite a bit more to that relationship I wish someone would research and sort out. There was a takeover of a women's college in, I think, 1972, Mills College, that was taken over in a scandal that I couldn't sort out. I would love to know what that was. I would love to know where the missing art is. There's an unknown number of Isamu Noguchi busts that were owned by the new school, one of which was Martha Graham. There was a John Cage bust. There was a Buckminster Fuller bust. I would like to know how many we owned and where they all are now. The Martha Graham bust came up for auction, I think, in the 80s, and the school decided not to pursue it, thinking it wouldn't be worth anything. That's what I heard, of course.
That was a big mistake.
I think the new school still owns that stuff. We haven't sold it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stolen art is a constant problem, but in theory, it all winds up being returned to the original owner once you find out who stole it and how it wound up in other people's hands.
I hope that that's the case. There are two paintings by Camillo Agas that are also missing. I thought that they were destroyed, but now the window of disappearance has been narrowed to about 2 years. I was actually in the building. I figured out by the architectural prints in the building where the original murals were, and went into the room, the audio room, and was feeling the walls. And Brian says, "Oh, I remember when they took those down." So we know that they were taken down and disappeared between 1992 and 1994. But there are two large paintings by Camillo Agas that are missing. Mm.
The school keeps on expanding. It opened a 16-story university center at 65 Fifth Avenue, 5 years ago. Students and village residents picketed. Why?
Well, it's a big behemoth of a building. From the outside, maybe less pleasing than it should be. From the inside, it's really quite useful. It has good areas. It's light. It's airy. For a giant spaceship, it feels pretty approachable.
Well, New York has a lot of ugly buildings going up every day.
Well,
is the new school being held to a higher standard?
The president who mounted that building was particularly unpopular, and he had good things about him and not so good things about him, but was really unable to deal with a radical population of faculty and students, and bungled that pretty massively. On the other hand, I think the building was really necessary, and that might be unpopular to some people.
Your book is filled with stories about people who have played a role in the history of the new school. I can't ask you about all of them, but are there some that are particular favorites of yours?
Well, my essay in the front of the book is an apology for the million people I should have written about. When I first started working on the project, I realized quickly that it could not be a project that represented everybody. If you do the math, about 10,000 to 15,000 people come through each year who were important. You see, that's a million people that you have to write about, and I can't do everything. I would love to know more about the Isamu Noguchi connection to the school, which I think was pushed aside somewhat because of, anti-Japanese sentiment. I would love to know more about
World War II?
I think that would percolate sort of through the decades. So I think it came and went. I would love to know more about Sarah Ruddick, who is an incredibly interesting philosopher associated with the school. I would love to know why the women's study at this school has been so difficult to maintain. There are all kinds of alluring mysteries.
And it is interesting that a school that definitely was trying to be different from other schools and encourage women to play a role. In the end, when you look at the long list of important people who have been through the new school, there are some famous women, but the list is dominated by men.
I tried to change that in this book a little bit. That history, there really have been a huge number of extraordinary women involved in the history of the school. I would love it if there were a Clara Mayer library. My office is in the footprint of her what was formerly her library.
And what was her major achievement?
Well, she was the vice president of the school for quite a while, and she was a dean at the school, and she worked under Alvin Johnson. She came to the school as a former student of Robinson's, so she was with the school from the very beginning. She was really a principal actor in terms of defining the academic programming of the school. She was pushed out in 1962 by Henry David, who was president of the school for 2 years, who during that time almost got us sold to NYU, was a complete catastrophe, and also pushed out Agnes DeLima, who was the publicity director of the school at the time, our best publicity director in history. She, there are marvelous soap opera elements too. She had been Alvin Johnston's girlfriend or mistress 20 years prior and had had a daughter with him, which was known by his wife, and they all got along. You know, it was a very progressive era. This was an extraordinary generation. They were a generation that survived World War I, lost family and loved ones, came back to the roaring 20s, the Depression, you know, outlived fascism in World War II, saw their children die in World War II, saw the 60s. It was really a quite amazing generation.
The reason I ask is, as we pointed out earlier, the school was started with some really radical intentions during the period of revolution of World War I, Dadaism in Europe, and of course the Soviet Revolution. And then you have all of these emigres from Hitler and Mussolini and the other fascist regimes of Europe during leading up to World War II. And yet I don't have a sense of the New School these days as being a particular hotbed of radicalism. There are radicals in our world right now. What happened to the New School?
I think the New School suffers from having become important to some degree. You know, it's 100 years old. It's no longer brand new. It has degrees. It has 10,000 students. It has an infrastructure.
So let's talk about the degrees. If I get a degree from the New School, can I then take that to Yale and say I want to teach here?
Sure.
It's the same as if I got a degree from Harvard or Columbia or Fordham or
sure.
NYU.
They're just regular old degrees like everywhere else. The PhDs, in fact, are very longstanding academic degrees.
Mm-hmm. So it's what it did is it became an established institution.
Yes, I'm afraid that's what happened.
And then they hired you. You've been there how many years now?
Well, I was an adjunct until just last year. So I was basically teaching one class a year for the first 10 years till, let's say, 2013. And then, I don't know, 18 years, something.
Mm-hmm. Able, even when you were an adjunct, to propose classes that you probably wouldn't have been able to do if you were an adjunct at some of the other universities.
Yeah, we did some really unusual classes over the years. We did a fake Andy Warhol documentary, a mockumentary where we created. Actually, that was one of the fun stories about this book, is I kept finding these tantalizing clues to our connection to the Warhol studio, which I couldn't quite track. I couldn't quite make sense of. And finally, I tracked the links back to a website that my own class had thrown up with this fake documentary, which had filtered its way into history as be made up. But we had done fairly well and were fairly convincing, and there I was chasing my own tail.
That's hilarious. Well, Andy Warhol isn't around to tell the world that it's not true.
So. No, and he might not anyway.
He might have enjoyed it. Well, so we have this book. I hate to tell you that the only thing I disliked about it was that it's so big and heavy that I had to schlep it around. But now it can go into a bookcase. And did it have to be this big?
Originally planned a book about a third the size. So we just couldn't do it. We couldn't make it a third the size.
and have it. It was important for it to be well designed, to be exciting to look at.
I think so, but it's 100 years is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were stuffing things in there until the last minute.
Isn't there going to be some kind of a festival celebrating the 100th anniversary?
The festival lasts for a week. It's the first week of October. There are tons of things on campus. There are free classes of all kinds, many, many events. I think that the hashtag is hashtag 100 years new. So if you want to follow that, it's pretty easy to track.
100 years new. And are you going to be participating in it?
I've got a few events set up with the writing program. I think that there's a reading, there's an after-hours reading at KGB Bar where we'll talk about some of the mysteries of the school. That's organized by Samantha Kirby in part, who was one of the researchers who worked on the book.
And will you be showing the Andy Warhol film?
No, but that's not a bad idea.
I've been talking with John Reed, who is a novelist, a playwright, an essayist, and poet, and now the author of a history, the history of the New School called A Drama in Time, The New School Century. It is published by Profile Books, and it's been my great pleasure to have you on our show today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to Tech Kevin O'Donohue and Nasima Dimar of the Positive Mind Center for allowing us to use their First Rate studio facilities. If you're new to our show and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter and our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. The Tom Hartman program is coming up next, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow when Danny Mena will discuss his new cookbook that takes you on a culinary tour of Mexico City. We'll see you then.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI New York, and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Leonard Lopate at Large, heard Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. Stay tuned for the Tom Hartman program, but first, news headlines from Democracy Now!
President Trump announced on Twitter Saturday he was calling off a secret meeting between himself, the Afghan president, and Taliban leaders that may have led to the withdrawal of thousands of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, although reports raise questions about the meeting's details and who exactly was going to take part. Trump said his decision was due to a Taliban car bomb last Thursday that killed 12 people in Kabul, including a U.S. soldier. Trump also said all further negotiations are being called off. The U.S. and Taliban had appeared close to an agreement after holding nine rounds of talks in Doha, even though the Afghan government had not taken part in those meetings. The New York Times reports Trump wanted the deal to be announced at the Camp David meeting so he would be perceived as the dealmaker who pulled the peace deal together. But according to the New York Times, Taliban negotiators had agreed to come to the United States only after a deal was announced and only to meet with the American side. At least 44 people are confirmed dead and the number is expected to soar exponentially as the Bahamas continues to reel from the devastation wrought by Hurricane Dorian. More than 70,000 people on Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands have been left homeless, and thousands remain missing. On Saturday, a cruise ship brought more than 1,500 Bahamians to a port in Florida. But Sunday, more than 100 people seeking aid and refuge in the United States were turned away after boarding a ferry bound for Florida. Before the boat left the Bahamas, passengers were